Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was skeptical about ordering foundation online. I can't even find a match in stores. Then I discovered Il Makiage. Their online quiz found my exact shade in seconds. With Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. But I was obsessed on day one. It's so lightweight and natural, it's literally my skin in a bottle. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 23rd of June, these are our main stories. The Trump administration has placed new restrictions on more Chinese state-run media outlets that have operations in the US, in a sign of worsening tensions between the two countries. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases around the world has passed 9 million, as the WHO warns the pandemic is accelerating. Facebook and Instagram are facing a growing boycott by advertisers who accuse them of not doing enough to tackle hate speech and false information. Also in this podcast,
we do a very, very quick ceremony. It's probably 3 minutes. We sign their documents on their behalf, put it back to court, get the marriage certificate, they're done.
A wedding with a difference. How to get hitched in the US state of Montana without attending in person. So, how good are relations between the United States and China? President Trump tends to say his relations with President Xi are excellent, but there's little sign of that being reflected in terms of what's going on now between the two nations. The long list of flashpoints includes trade, technology, military power, and who's to blame for the COVID-19 pandemic. Now the US has cranked up the undeclared war another notch by saying four Chinese media outlets are foreign missions. A State Department official described them as government propaganda mouthpieces. Barbara Plaitusher in Washington told me why the US had made this declaration now.
So this is Act Two, really. The first act was back in February when the State Department designated five Chinese media companies as foreign missions. And this was because it had determined that they are directly controlled by the Chinese government and Chinese Communist Party. And I think also within the context of being more and more concerned about efforts by overseas media organizations to influence public opinion, especially as you're entering an election year. So it designated five media organizations. And then over the course of the next weeks and months, there was a sort of a back and forth about this. The Chinese expelled a number of journalists in response. The State Department or the administration froze the visas of certain media organizations, which meant that they also had to leave. Then more journalists were expelled. So it's kind of built up since then. And this is the latest round, really, and that's four news organizations designated this time. The State Department official who spoke to us described it as housekeeping, sort of finishing off, I suppose, what they had started. But he was asked, well, how do you expect the Chinese to respond? They've already expelled quite senior American journalists over this. And he responded by saying, well, we have to look after ourselves and protect ourselves from China's intrusive propaganda machine, he called it. China would do what it would do, he said. Rather ironically, in that same call, he was asked about whether there had been any reaction from regional allies about revelations in a book published by John Bolton, who made some claims about President Trump and China. And then that journalist's line was muted. And then when it was brought up again later, the journalist who did so was rebuked. So it was sort of ironic that that kind of atmosphere pervaded on a call which was supposed to be about China and press freedom.
So is this, do you think, a deepening rift between the United States and China? And what does it tell us about the relationship between President Trump and President Xi?
Yes, I think it probably is a sign of the deepening rift. And I especially see how China responds to this. But it's although it may have had its own particular dynamics, it is part also of a wider of growing tensions between the two countries in different areas. And that was particularly deepened over the pandemic. The Trump administration has become more and more vocal about criticizing China for the way that was handled. So I think that this falls into part of the, the growing tensions between China and the U.S. And also Trump administration anger at China has become part of the election campaign. It's all part of that sort of climate.
Barbara Platasha in Washington. Across the world, the number of confirmed cases of coronavirus has headed past 9 million, and the head of the World Health Organization is warning that its spread is still accelerating. Speaking at an online forum, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the economic and other effects of the pandemic will be felt for decades to come, and he criticized leaders and countries for not doing as well as they should.
The world is in desperate need of national unity and global solidarity. The politicization of the pandemic has exacerbated it. Ultimately, the pandemic has shown that we are humanity, one humanity, and none of us are safe until all of us are safe.
I heard more from our global health correspondent, Naomi Grimley.
He gave a briefing to all the press, the global media, and he was talking about another grim milestone, really, because the WHO has had 183,000 cases reported in the last 24 hours. And he pointed out that was easily the most they've had in any one day. So the message from the WHO is this crisis is still accelerating. It's still a big problem. Yes, some countries may be easing, but globally, cases are growing.
And Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, he's criticised the lack of solidarity and the lack of leadership when it comes to the pandemic. Is that aimed, do you think, at President Trump, who's cut ties, America's ties with the WHO?
Yes, I think almost certainly that will be interpreted as a sideswipe at America. Remember, last month, President Trump pulled America out of the WHO, arguing that it was too China-centric. And the withdrawal of funding that will amount to $550 million per year. So one of the things that the head of the WHO went on to talk about this morning when he addressed an online health forum was the need for properly funded healthcare regulations across the world. And I think it was almost certain that he was having a go at President Trump. But of course, it was couched in a very diplomatic manner.
And how important is the World Health Organization when it comes to combating a pandemic like this one?
Well, of course, it's crucial. I mean, one of the things they're trying to do at the moment is get protective equipment to some of the most vulnerable countries in the world, such as Yemen, also testing, getting testing up in areas such as Africa, where low testing is probably leading to the underreporting of cases. But at the same time, the WHO has a massive brief. It's also responsible for making sure that vaccinations go on for other diseases. So one of the things that critics say is that it needs to perhaps in future focus more on its role in preventing big pandemics like this one.
Naomi Grimley. In Venezuela, tougher lockdown measures have come into force in 10 Venezuelan states and the capital Caracas as the number of coronavirus infections increases. The authorities have closed the metro system in Caracas and set up roadblocks on the main highways outside the city. Officially, Venezuela has one of the best records on COVID-19 in Latin America, with 4,000 confirmed cases and just over 30 deaths. Portugal says it's reintroducing coronavirus restrictions in the capital, Lisbon, to help control new outbreaks in the region. The Prime Minister, António Costa, said the measures, which just came into force at midnight local time, include a ban on gatherings of more than 10 people, no drinking in public places, and earlier closing times for stores in the affected areas. Saudi Arabia has announced that the annual Hajj pilgrimage will go ahead at the end of July, but with attendance sharply reduced because of the pandemic. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston has the details.
In normal times, the Hajj pilgrimage is one of the great moments in the Muslim religious calendar. Well over 2 million worshippers make their way to Mecca from across the globe. But this year, in the shadow of the coronavirus, the Saudi authorities say the event will have to be dramatically reduced in scale. Just a very limited number of believers will be allowed to attend. There'll be citizens from countries around the world who are already resident in Saudi Arabia. The authorities say this is the only way they'll be able to make plans for social distancing that will keep people safe.
Alan Johnston. Despite the rise in the number of cases of COVID-19, many countries are coming out of lockdown. As they do so, what have we learned from experiencing a pandemic? And how will this knowledge affect future politics and society, even our own lives? Well, in a series called Rethink, the BBC has asked a group of high-profile leaders and thinkers to tell us not what they predict will happen, but what they want to happen. Pope Francis tells us of his hopes for a more contemplative society.
This crisis is affecting us all, rich and poor alike, and putting a spotlight on hypocrisy. I am worried by the hypocrisy of certain political personalities who speak of facing up to the crisis, of the problem of hunger in the world, but who in the meantime manufacture weapons. This is a time to be converted from this kind of functional hypocrisy. It's a time for integrity. Either we are coherent with our beliefs or we will lose everything. Today, I believe we have to slow down our rate of production and consumption and to learn to understand and contemplate the natural world. And speaking of contemplation, I'd like to dwell on one point.
Es el momento de ver al pobre. Jesús nos dice,
this is the moment to see the poor. Jesus says we will have the poor with us always, and that is the truth. But the poor are hidden because poverty is bashful. They are there, but we don't see them because we don't want to see them. We often treat the poor like rescued animals. We can't settle for a partial welfare policy. I'm going to dare to offer some advice. This is the time to go to the underground. I'm thinking of Dostoevsky's short novel, Notes from the Underground. The employees of that prison hospital had become so inured, they treated their poor prisoners like things. And seeing the way they treated one who had just died, the one on the bed alongside tells them, enough. He too had a mother. We need to tell ourselves this often. That poor person had a mother who raised him lovingly. It helps to think of that love he once received through his mother's hope. We disempower the poor, and to see them, to really see them, can help us to discover the piety, the pietas, which points towards God and towards our neighbor. Go down into the underground and pass from the hypervirtual, fleshless world to the suffering flesh of the poor. This is the conversion we have to undergo. And if we don't start there, it won't happen. It won't happen.
Pope Francis, and his words were read by Joseph Balderrama. Growing trees to fight climate change has never been more popular, but now two new studies have revealed that the large-scale planting of trees to combat climate change may do more harm than good. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath has been looking at the research.
There's been a big push in the last number of years as countries have looked at, I suppose, easier ways of getting at the climate problem and soaking up emissions. And many of them have hit on the idea of planting trees. And there are a number of different initiatives. There's a trillion tree challenge, which is expecting countries to plant a trillion trees over the next coming years. Countries like Ethiopia managed to plant 350 million trees in one day last year. So it's obviously very popular, but there's growing scientific concern, I would say, about whether this is having the impact that all these countries think it's having. And so these researchers have looked at two different things. One of them looked in at Chile, the country in South America, where they've been paying landowners to plant trees, new trees, new forests for several decades now. But they found what's happening is that the landowners, many of them, are cutting down old native forests and planting new trees because they get subsidies up to 75% of the cost. And what that means is that the trees, the old trees with lots of carbon and lots of biodiverse lifestyles in them, are being cut down, and the new trees which don't have so much carbon and don't have so much biodiversity are replacing them. So that's, they say that's not a good thing. The other study looks at the question of how much carbon these trees can absorb, and it finds that not as much as many have written about in the past.
How much do they absorb them? How much do they help?
Trees definitely are a good thing. There's no way that they're not a good thing in the fight against climate change. But the idea that simply just by planting millions of trees we can get out of the issue of rising temperatures this century is mistaken, many scientists think. It's too neat, it's too clean to say just plant trees and everything will be okay. And you remember, trees are at the back of many of the offsetting schemes that airlines and other companies use to put off their emissions, if you like. So there's a lot of scientific discontent, if you like, about the whole idea. Trees are a great thing. Planting them does help, but perhaps not as much as we have thought, been led to believe up to now.
Matt McGrath. And still to come in the podcast.
We've been carrying out geophysical surveys around the Stonehenge landscape for a number of years. We realised that some rather massive splodges we'd seen in the data were being repeated on a massive scale.
So what did archaeologists find just a short distance from the prehistoric Stonehenge monument in southwest England? Find out later. The American sporting goods producer Patagonia is the latest in a line of companies to suspend advertising on Facebook because of the perception that the social media giant isn't doing enough to tackle hate speech online. Patagonia says it wouldn't put any ads on the social media platform and its subsidiary Instagram until at least the end of July. I asked our technology correspondent Rory Kethlen-Jones what the firm is hoping to achieve.
It's joining in a campaign which is organised by six civil rights groups, including the Anti-Defamation League, Colours of Change and Common Sense. They're trying to change Facebook's policy during the month of July to pressure it to take more action to prevent, in particular, the spread of hate speech and misinformation. This is a campaign that's really born, again, out of the recent Black Lives Matter protests and the feeling that Facebook has been very lax in really regulating its platform. In particular, one particular incident where Twitter put a warning up about something that Donald Trump said when he used the expression, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, and Facebook let it lie, did not take action. And that caused a lot of disquiet, both externally and internally. There was something of an internal revolt about it.
So is this really aimed at President Trump, do you think?
Well, I think it's aimed more in particular, that's one of the issues, but it's aimed more in particular at Facebook, which has over the years trod this very difficult line between, it says, not wanting to sort of crack down on free speech excessively, but wanting to say that it does care about these issues. And we've seen before, remember back in 2016, when it faced so much criticism over the presidential election campaign then, and in the couple of years afterwards when it emerged, Cambridge Analytica scandal emerged, then there were a whole bunch of campaigns to delete Facebook, and it was rocked then, and now it's the advertisers, which is more serious. But let's be clear, there's just a few advertisers, big brands, are probably going to stay with Facebook.
Rory Kethlen-Jones. Voters in Malawi returned to the polls on Tuesday for a rerun of the presidential election after the Constitutional Court annulled in February the results of a disputed vote. The incumbent, President Peter Mutharika, had initially been declared the narrow winner of the May 2019 vote. But opposition leaders challenged the results in court, complaining of massive irregularities. Judges agreed with them and nullified the poll results in February and ordered a repeat of the election. Emmanuel Igunza reports.
For months now, Malawians have been under a political crisis unlike any other they've faced in their history. But the win of President Peter Mutharika was overturned by the courts for alleged irregularities during the vote. But in the run-up to Tuesday's repeat polls, the country has been bitterly divided. There have been widespread anti-government protests and violence that threaten to plunge Malawi into an even deeper crisis. The chairperson of the country's electoral commission also stepped down, and a new team to oversee the election has been put in place. In the streets, ordinary people are worn out by the limbo and hope Tuesday's vote will change things for the better.
I think it is very important for me to vote on Tuesday because I believe the government administration always influences the future of its citizens.
I hope voting will change things because I have children, two boys, who I struggled to send to school. I had to get into the business of selling chickens to raise their school fees. My hope is that they will, in turn, help me. But up to now, they have no jobs. Some parties have been promising jobs for the youth. It's good that we go to vote, so that our children can find something to do for a living.
The vote will pit incumbent Peter Mutharika, who is seeking a second and final five-year term in office, and veteran politician Lazarus Chakwera, a former evangelist who has united the opposition under a coalition looking to unseat the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, which was formed in 2004 by the current president's brother.
Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika, 1,436,870.
In many ways, this election will also be held under different rules after the court ruled that the first-past-the-post system was unconstitutional. Malawian political analyst Humphrey Mvula explains what's at stake.
For the first time, we'll be voting on a 50-plus-1 explanation where a successful candidate must be able to achieve not less than 50-plus-1 of those that have registered to vote on the 23rd of June. Unlike the 10 or so candidates in the past, we really have restricted it to two main candidate contenders and one support candidate.
Whoever wins the race will have to heal the deep divisions in Malawi and end the vicious cycle of violence witnessed over the past year. Tackling corruption, poverty reduction and unemployment are also other key electoral issues.
Emmanuel Igunza. Archaeologists here in Britain have discovered a major prehistoric monument a short distance from Stonehenge in southwest England. Fieldwork has uncovered at least 20 massive shafts, which are more than 10 metres across and 5 metres deep, and were excavated more than 4,500 years ago. Professor Vincent Gaffney of Bradford University is the lead researcher on the project. Razia Iqbal asked him what exactly has been found.
We've been carrying out geophysical surveys around the Stonehenge landscape for a number of years. A short while ago, we realised that some rather massive splodges we'd seen in the data were being repeated on a massive scale. They create a circle about 2 kilometres around what was previously one of Britain's biggest archaeological sites, the Henge at Durrington Walls. We've looked at these, we've cored them, and we now realise there's a series of massive pits, and we think they're forming some form of sacred boundary around this site. And it's only a very small distance from Stonehenge.
So, and what do you make of what they were used for then? Is there any indication you were at least working in this area for some time?
We're essentially trying to look in between the monuments we knew about to see if there were things that we actually had not yet located. Now, these massive pits, and there may be an internal palisade to them as well, seem to be demarcating an area which perhaps you weren't allowed into, a religious, a ritual area, or you were guided through to the site, perhaps by the way of the River Avon, to an avenue which leads up to the large Henge monument at Durrington. But this is unique. We've never actually seen anything like this at this scale before.
Professor Vincent Gaffney of Bradford University. And now, famous chords of the bridal chorus popularly known as Here Comes the Bride, or these days, perhaps not. For most people planning to get married this year, coronavirus has meant having to cancel or postpone the big day, as large gatherings have been banned and many venues remain closed. But a very old law in Montana in the United States has allowed couples to get married, although in a most unusual way. Gareth Barlow has more.
Amid the big skies of the US state of Montana, weddings are taking place, but they aren't your typical ceremonies. Despite getting married, neither the bride nor groom are present. Montana is the only US state to allow double proxy weddings, where two people, known as proxies, stand in for the happy couple, saying the vows and signing the register on their behalf. Tom Kennedy runs a business arranging double proxy marriages.
The paperwork and the legal work is done online. It goes through an attorney. We supply the marriage license from the court. We have myself as minister and then two proxies stand in. We do a very, very quick ceremony. It's probably 3 minutes. We sign their documents on their behalf, put it back to the court, get the marriage certificate. They're done.
Montana's law allows anyone from the state and anyone serving in the U.S. Armed Forces to have a double proxy wedding. And it's people in the military who typically use the service. With U.S. troops confined to their bases because of the pandemic, requests by military couples have risen. Tom's company normally officiates around 40 marriages a month. But since lockdown restrictions were imposed to contain the coronavirus, the number of ceremonies has soared to around 200 a month. Here's Tom again.
Young men and women cannot leave base after basic training to get married or after their secondary training to get married. So their plans went awry and they're stuck with proxy marriage.
For a few hundred dollars, couples can get married and obtain all the benefits that matrimony has to offer. For couples with a husband or wife serving in the military, it means their spouse can benefit from insurance and housing allowances and be deployed with their partner, privileges that unmarried couples don't enjoy. 19-year-old Savannah Phillips has just got married by proxy to her husband Luke, who serves with the US Air Force.
We plan to have a regular wedding, you know, plan it out and have all our family and friends there. And then with coronavirus, we have been separated for so long, we just didn't know when the coronavirus would be over. And so we started exploring our other options. We just figured that was a great option for us so we could go ahead and get married.
Nestled in the northwest of the US next to the border with Canada, Montana isn't a state that often makes the headlines. But with the coronavirus changing lives and changing the way we live, the place often called the Treasure State is allowing people to marry their treasured sweethearts regardless of the pandemic.
Our very own wedding planner there, Gareth Barlow. One of Hollywood's best-known directors of the 1980s and 90s, Joel Schumacher, has died at the age of 80. He began as a costume designer and went on to direct films such as the hit St. Elmo's Fire in 1985. Joel Schumacher then took over the Batman franchise, making Batman Forever, starring Val Kilmer, and Batman and Robin, which George Clooney said was so bad it almost killed his career.
There's something about an anatomically correct rubber suit that puts fire in a girl's lips. Let me kiss you.
Stop! Don't kiss her.
What are you talking about? You got some real issues with women, you know that? You just couldn't stand it. She was going to kiss me and not you. Couldn't stand it. Something was going to be mine and not yours, could you?
Well, I heard more about Joel Schumacher's films from our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd, and I suggested to him that Mr. Schumacher had made quite a lot of money.
He did. He was a big commercial blockbuster director for part of his career. There was some forgettable stuff going back to the 70s. Then came St. Elmo's Fire, as we said, which was classic 80s Brat Pack stuff with Rob Lowe and all those people. What defined his career always, though, were those two Batman movies, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. Slightly unfairly, Batman and Robin in particular has made some critics' list of the worst movies ever. OK, it was showy, it was maybe a bit too camp. It was boldly gay for a mainstream movie, and as a gay man, Schumacher was drawing attention to the possible subtext between the two main characters. But on the whole, audiences didn't like it, and the whole franchise died a death until Christopher Nolan took it over rather later. George Clooney, in particular, hated Batman and Robin, although I have to say Michael Goff was the best Alfred ever. Joel Schumacher said after Batman and Robin, he just lost his taste for turning out big blockbusters.
I purposely withdrew
from the blockbuster world. I'd never quite planned on it, and it happened, and it was great. Except by Batman and Robin, the box office started to feel more important than the movie. Merchandise and toys and, you know, the naked commercialism of it. It became very unrewarding after a while.
So then he went for more low-budget movies, didn't he?
It's terribly hard to characterise his career. He did direct big commercial films, for instance, from John Grisham thrillers, such as A Time to Kill with Sandra Bullock. They did OK. But basically, he reinvented himself with films such as 8mm with Nicolas Cage and The Flawless with De Niro. He directed Veronica Guerin with Cate Blanchett, set in Ireland. You would not have expected him to make that film, maybe. And in 2004, he directed the movie version of the musical The Phantom of the Opera. Critics didn't much like it, but it made money. And by 2011, really, his career in cinema was over, but he made a couple of episodes of House of Cards for TV. The truth is, Joel Schumacher was given a big Hollywood franchise to look after. Things didn't go too well. That's something his career never totally recovered from, but he did not give up. He kept working.
I'm going to put you on the spot. I mean, where does he come in the pantheon?
Incredibly good commercial filmmaker, and that's what Hollywood lives on.
Vincent Dowd. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast, perhaps you have your own ideas about how life should be after lockdown, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Working from home? Conference calls?
You're still on mute, John.
With everything we have going on right now, it's never been more important to get the sleep we need. Quality sleep is a natural immune booster, and only the Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts your comfort and support on both sides, your Sleep Number setting. So, all those other things we're doing to stay healthy and happy, well, they'll work better too. And now, during the lowest prices of the season, the Queen Sleep Number 360 C4 smart bed is only $12.99. Save $400, only for a limited time. To learn more, go to sleepnumber.com.